right, it's 8:35, 5 minutes into the hour. We can start the recording. Good morning, everyone. My name is Maggie Sarad. I'm the VP of Contractual Compliance. Thank you for joining us this morning for the Contractual Compliance Program Update. This session is open to everyone at the ICANN meeting and also open remotely participation. Our goal today is to provide you a very high-level update on developments and activities since ICANN 53, and then most of the session is going to be open to all of you, dialogue with us. With me in the audience on my left is Alan Grogan, my boss, and then I have Jennifer, Leticia, Owen, Zuhra, and Elif, joining me from the compliance team. We have most of our compliance staff members participating remotely. So with this, we're going to get started. This session is being recorded. So the first update since ICANN 53 we launched a compliance awareness campaign. We became aware through our communications team and the ICANN website administrators that they are receiving a lot of questions from domainers, from registrants, from different sources about where can I file a complaint, how do I file a complaint, and all of those different questions. So we launched a campaign with the help of our communication team, and the objective is very simply to improve the knowledge and awareness to the community about contractual compliance. We made a very simple video campaign about getting to know contractual compliance, and also a very simple handout about what is contractual compliance complaint. The links provided here, and they're also posted on YouTube, but also on our landing page for the compliance. All of this material is available in 8 languages. This slide was provided to us also by our communication team. We launched the campaign from 15th to 28th of September. And for those of you familiar with the terminology organic versus paid, when it first launched, and then a few days later, our communication team launched a paid campaign for it. And you can see the return on investment. For a couple of $100 of investment, we were able to really up the access and the visibility to our video and to the data. We're still in the process of finalizing on the Chinese video and reaching to the different audiences, as you can see. Another area we continue to report to the community on is our continuous improvement updates. Continuous improvement comes from different sources. Sometimes it could be a system update, for example, and those system updates usually are not optional. For example, a software update to improve our security on the tool. We have a lot of our updates or continuous improvements are led either by feedback from the community, including contracted parties, about the systems or the responses from compliance, or it could be initiated by policy developments or policies that are going to be implemented. So it's not only the contracted parties who have to get ready for new policies that are coming down the pipeline. We also need to be able to address and have the system work through the nuances or the changes of the policies. Audit activities. We report on those at every meeting because we're continually conducting audits with the contracted parties. The audit objective is twofold. One is to be able to share with the community and for the public to let them know that we are and we have a stable and secure environment. But the second objective is for us also to be able to address proactively any opportunities for us to be to have and address any issues that might show. So an audit allows us to work with the contracted parties proactively, identifying potential issues, and sometimes when we think it's an issue, it may be something that the contracted party is conducting their business or accumulating data in a different fashion, and we just need clarification. But it helps us to be very aware of the environment and to address any non-compliance issues proactively so it avoids any future areas of issues. So the first update is the new registry agreement audit program. We completed the March 2015 audit, and what you're going to see us refer to is the by the month that it was launched. So the March 2015 audit was conducted for 11 registries, and by the time we concluded the audit phase and the remediation and the reporting, we had one registry operator who still was in the remediation phase, and as of today, that registry operator has completed the remediation, and it's now, so all 11 are in compliance. The audit report is published, and the audit report will provide you not only the list of the participants, but also some of the top issues that we encountered and how they impact the community and how they were addressed. Another audit underway we launched in September is the registrar audit. The scope was 69 registrars, and we completed the request for information phase. As of this week, all 69 registrars have made it to the audit phase. What that means is in the request for information phase, all contracted parties uploaded the data as requested, and now the team is reviewing them. We had zero enforcement. We are also in the process of globalizing the audit page. Globalizing the audit page, meaning that we are going to provide data in all 8 languages, and the data we're going to provide here is going to be templates. We have received a lot of requests from the community. Well, what does the notice look like when you send an audit request? What does the communication with the contracted party look like? What does the audit report look like? So what we're going to do is create templates of all this communication that we have with the contracted parties throughout the audit process, translate them to the 8 languages, and publish them on our website. So hopefully by the next ICANN meeting, we will have this ready for us. Provided slide 9 to share with the community about the different criteria we take into consideration when we launch an audit. A very simple criteria is if you've never been audited, we roll them in. Again, the objective of the audit is we're not going to audit all now. We have over about 2,000 registrars. It's not the goal to audit all 2,000 every time, twice a year. It's not the goal to audit all 600-plus registries every time. No. It's to do a sampling based on the criteria listed on this slide. One of the criteria is also, for example, if we have had a contracted party that had a breach in the last 12 months. So it's our proactive approach to make sure that we do not have a repeat or an issue. Provided a slide here on slide 10, all this material is already published in the schedule. To list and share with the community, what are some of the issues we saw in this registry agreement audit that was just completed? The registrar agreement that launched in September, as I just said, is in the audit phase now and will follow the standard compliance approach through the 1-2-3 notification process. The slides just for your reference where some of the registrars that are in scope are coming from. Again, we will take questions at the end. I'm not going to walk you through every slide. The material is available to you, but we'll be happy to take questions later to any slide you want to talk to. The global metrics I want to highlight just for 2 minutes here is what we started to do now is we added a column that refers us to the previous ICANN meeting, so we can start showing a bit of a trend, what's going on. And we also, part of our ongoing reporting is we also report to the community about not just the volume, but mostly about the turnaround time from the contracted parties and from ICANN line staff. Because again, there's a perception there is no collaboration or no work. To the contrary, look at the turnaround times, and those are measured in business days. It's an average because the turnaround time depends on the type of complaint we are working with. For example, who is inaccuracies by contract require us 15 days. We have other contractual obligations that require 4 hours or 24 hours. But this is the average, taking into account all the different complaints we process and we share it with the community. And the same on the registry side also. With this, I'm going to turn it to Owen Smigelski to provide a high-level update on the activities since ICANN 53 for registrars.
Thank you, Maggie. So I'm not going to go into great detail on these slides, just kind of high-level highlights, let you know that the WHO is ARS Phase 1, sampling WHO is data for and determine whether it complies with the standards of the 2009 and 2013 REA. That report was published. There's a link to that on there, as well as a webinar that was done regarding that. Compliance received the domains that were identified as having areas of non-compliance, and that's in process. We had to change our system in order to accept that file. The previous WHO is ARS pilot, there were some issues with the data that was provided, and ultimately we didn't really end up processing many of those. A lot more data that's in there so that the contractor parties will be able to know specifically what the problem is with that. Next slide, please. These are the some of the highlights of issues that compliance does continue to see with registrars regarding some of the issues of the 20th REA, as well as the consensus policies. Big one being the verification validation of WHO is data, which is something that's under consideration with the main REA WHO is accuracy program specification review, as well as still seeing some registrars not sending domain renewal reminders at the times. Next slide, please. July 31st of this year, there was an update to the UDRP rules. Big change is that registrars are now required to lock a domain subject to a UDRP. Confirm that the lock has been done, as well as provide the information requested in the verification request from the provider. There's also a requirements about what they have to do with the locks afterwards, as well as more communication requirements regarding the UDRP. We had to update our complaint forms, so we have actually been receiving complaints from ERP providers that the locks have not amended. So that form has been modified, as well as our system. Slide, please. Another thing that continues to be a high profile are abuse reports. And so this slide just kind of shows some of the things that ICANN can do in response to a request. All of those reports from reporters are confirmed. We do want to check to make sure that the reporter has actually contacted the registrar and is not just contacting ICANN as a first source, and we want to see all communications between the reporter and the registrar, both registrar and from the registrar, before forwarding that to the party. There are certain levels of actions that registrars can take based upon that. At a minimum, ICANN is looking to see that the abuse complaint was forwarded to the front, and then some additional things that can be done as well are listed up on the slide. Next slide, please. Here are some of the policy efforts that compliance staff, various compliance staff, participated in the last ICANN meeting. The change to the transfer policy, which will be coming up August of next year, IRTPD, and some of the other things there as well, too, including the RDDS, some big changes coming to that for the contractor parties. This is just a summary of the various, all the different registrar complaint types that we get from largest volume to lowest volume and comparing that between the two ICANN meetings. Just highlight the ones that are closed before first inquiry or notice. That those are ones that either information from the reporter is requested. It could also be about a who is an accurate complaint about somebody's own domain name or a domain renewal for a domain that's already been renewed. So those are ones that all tickets are reviewed manually by staff before sent to contracted parties, and so those reflect closed. Next slide. This is just giving you the top closure reasons for various complaint types. The who is an accuracy is the largest bucket, and the biggest way that those complaints are resolved is the domain is either suspended or canceled. All right, there, and just giving you some more information. You're free to go through that. Is the press line? Yes, it is. Okay. So it is online, and I apologize to the Adobe Connect that some of those slides aren't coming through on there. But
good morning. This is Jennifer Scott. ICANN staff on the registry side. I'll just want to let you know that since ICANN 53, staff has been continuing to process registry operator-related complaints to work with registry operators to ensure enforcement and compliance with the registry agreement. These are some of the high-interest items that we've been seeing since ICANN 53, including continuation of registry operators processing requests third parties in the centralized zone data service, as well as line with the controlled interruption and uniform rapid suspension system requirement. Similar to the registrar side of things, staff has also been involved with registry-related policy and working groups. The most recent of these was the already issued advisory for the correction of non-compliant ROIDs, which is a repository object identifier. These identifiers are used in a variety of things, including who is output, EPP, and data escrow, among other things. And we've noticed that a number of GTLD registry operators have been using ROIDs that are not in the correct format, and therefore an advisory was issued indicating that warnings will be issued if they're not corrected by the 2nd of November of this year, with strict enforcement occurring at the end of January of 2016. Staff has also been focused on making sure that registry operators are complying with the Uniform Rapid Suspension System, or URS. This is a rights protection mechanism related to trademark infringement that requires registry operators to lock a domain name subject to a URS complaint within 24 hours of receiving notice of the complaint from the URS provider. And similar to the registrar volume metrics, here are the registry ones also listed by volume of complaint type and also showing those that were closed before notice or inquiry was ever sent to the registry operator. And also similar to the registrar complaints, here are some of the top closure reasons that are used to close out complaints related to registries, including those in zone file access and data escrow. And again, those for service level agreement complaints and the reserve names or controlled interruption complaints.
With this, we conclude our presentation to you, and we would like to open it for dialogue with all of you. And before you speak, please identify yourself and your affiliation.
Good morning. This is Padmini from the Center for Internet and Society India. I had a question about your third-party audit partner, and I'm quoting from a documentary information disclosure response that ICANN had given to me. So you said that there was a request for proposal to select a third-party audit partner, which was designed and approved in May 2012. And this RFP was a directed RFP, since the specific skill set and capabilities required for this service was only found in certain potential vendors in the marketplace during a pre-selection process. Now, I understand that the third-party auditor appointed was KPMG in this case. So I was wondering, could you elaborate a little bit on these specific skill sets and capabilities, please?
This is Maggie Sarad. Yes, the specific skill sets, as you know, being in the ICANN industry, this is new. There is no audits been written for this environment. But the specific skill sets we looked for are very simple. Some of them can range from presence globally. As you would see and notice from our audit reports, we received documentation in the last couple of them in 20-plus languages. We needed somebody also who had the tools and the ability to address audits and work with us on it. So we list all that, I think, in the DITP, or if I don't have them all memorized, but I remember clearly we looked for organizations that have global presence, but not just presence, but also the global skill sets to address it directly and be able to be present globally and work with the community on it.
Just a quick follow-up to that. So I'm quoting again, you said ICANN will continue to evaluate whether the public interest in disclosing the RFP outweighs the harm that may be caused by such disclosure. So I was wondering, are you considering publishing the RFP for the public anytime soon?
So what we are considering to do, Puma, is not just publishing the RFP form, because the RFP form can vary. The audits are not always the same. An audit sometimes can be focused on one area, or it can be all-inclusive. What we have tried to do is, through the outreach and the documentation that you will see either through the outreach section of the compliance audit pages, through the outreach web page or through the audit page, we publish different provisions, but not necessarily the RFP that we send, because it's more of an operational direct work that we do with the contract parties. But what we provide the community, again, for the sake of transparency, we list everything that we are working on or could be a potential scope for the RFP.
Maxim Alzoba, FIT, for the record. Could you please clarify if the delay in delivering results of audit of this year for Greece is a result of those special qualifications of the audit company, or is it just forgotten to be delivered? What was the reason?
Thank you, Maxime. This is Maggie. So if I go to this slide here. Usually during the request for information phase, which is the first notice of an audit, the contracted parties are given 15 business days to respond to the different questions that are posed or upload the data. And we go through the 1-2-3 process to allow for collaboration. And what happens is, by the end of the third phase of that 1-2-3 process, if a contracted party still has not uploaded their documentation, then an enforcement will take place. So the delay here in this remediation was not a delay because of interpretation or dialogue. Is that this contracted party, as you see from the topic, data escrow format and issues, those had systematic needs to be conducted and applied. And that's why the remediation plan proposed by the contracted party, kind of the date over, extended beyond the audit date. And so we follow it separately, but we close that audit report program for that one section. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, simpler form. When should we expect the end of the summer audit?
For the registry agreement that was conducted?
Yes, because in previous meetings we saw timelines.
Yes.
With the end, like August or something. Do you have new dates?
It, as you notice, the first bullet, it says we completed the March 2015 audit program. So that audit that was launched in March completed. Now we have a registrar audit underway, and we will be in the process of planning a next round of registry.
The question is, reports to the audited party were not delivered. We would like to see at least the timeline. When should we expect it? Because my compliance, my legal department asks me, are we in the phase of passing audit, or are we still under investigation, or what's going on? Because I provided them with the data from your previous slides, and suddenly we see nothing about the timeline. Are we okay or not?
Let me get back to you directly, because all the audit reports have been delivered, the individual contracted parties. But let me follow up with you separately on that one. Thank you.
Maggie, Jim Prendergast with the Galway Strategy Group. While we're on the slide, in the intersessional in Los Angeles, there was a talk of, particularly from the registrars, about those that had been given the notice that they might be included in the audit program, those that had not been selected getting an affirmative email letting them know that they had not been selected. That get implemented with this round, or is that a future round?
Thank you, Jim, for that, for the question. Yes, it was implemented with this round. And if I may share with the audience,
sure.
So what happened at the GDD summit, which is the intersessional summit that took place in September, it was led by the GDD group, and compliance was part of that summit because we were on the agenda to discuss different areas. There was a request from the contracted parties that even though we send of what we call a pre-audit notification, and a pre-audit notification is not a contractual obligation, it's just a way of informing everybody an audit is going to start, that we would send it to all contracted parties, and then those who would be selected will be receiving a request for information. So at the summit, what we heard from the contracted parties is, When you send a pre-audit notification, if we are not selected, can you please let us know, even though the notification says, if you are selected, you will receive. So by default, if you don't receive, you're not selected. But they wanted an additional communication. So we did implement that with this round. And to my surprise, it caused more confusion than not sending one. I'd be happy to talk to you offline, too. We received a lot of questions. Why are you sending me this? And so, especially those that were not present and did not participate at the summit. So, you know, there's a struggle here. How much do we communicate, and when do we draw the line on the communication?
Be careful of what you ask for.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad to hear you did that, because I think that's compliance actually working together with the contract parties in a positive way and responding to requests. So I think great example, even though it may have wound up causing more confusion in the end. Also, question, when you audit, both for registries and for registrars, do you audit by accreditation or do you audit by family?
Yes and yes. So we, as you know, for the rest of the audience members, every contracted party has a different business model. Some contracted parties, if we speak of registrars, and I'm not talking about vertical integration, I'm just talking registrars, they may have other registrars that they are associated with. So one of the things we ask in the audit, again, we want to be proactive in the audit request, but we also want to be reasonable, because many of them operate within the same model, meaning same processes, same systems, same compliance team. So we do ask that question, and a lot of times when we check before we conduct an audit, that association has not been relayed to us yet, but the registrars let us know. And we do audit by the accreditation. So the three-year program focused on the 2001 and 2009 at the time. Now this audit is mostly focused on 2013 RAA. However, with one caveat, as you can see here on this next slide, 9, is that sometimes those who were part of a previous audit, but they had a breach in the last 12 months and maybe on the 2009 may be rolled back in.
So just in a follow-up, what sort of drove my question on that was a statistic that Ock gave during his operational update on Monday, that Buenos Aires meeting, which was in June, ICANN has added 579 new. So do you have a plan in place to growth? And I hear it's continuing. How is compliance going to handle all that? I mean, Owen's great, but geez. You know?
So, yes, we do have a plan. And it could be some, like I said, this is one of the criteria. Being new, but not having any domain names registered, is also takes them off the criteria. So you have to be reasonable when you look at this selection. What is the activity level? What are the domain name registration volume? We also look at the new nuances, if there are available opportunities. And one minor correction, Owen is responsible for the operational aspect, which is the complaints. We do have a risk and audit manager who is separate and operates for the audits.
And I guess the third-party audit provider, too, gives you some of that surge capacity?
So, yes, for what we call augmentation, yes.
Got it.
But it's always the contractual compliance ICANN team who has the direct communication ownership. They are a staff augmentation to operate with us.
We have remote question. Zuhra, contractual compliance. We have question from remote participant Heath Dixon. You said that when a complaint is received, you check whether the complainant contacted the registrar. Is the only question whether the registrar was contacted, or do you evaluate the quality of the contact? If it is more than a binary question about contact, how do you evaluate the quality of the pre-complainant contact?
Hey, Heath. This is Owen Smigelski for the record. So I made that reference to an abuse complaint, but there are a number of complaint types that we do check to see if the reporter has contacted the registrar or sometimes the registry operator. I can speak only to the registrar side. For example, if it's a transfer complaint, that's also another complaint type that we check to see whether a reporter has contacted the registrar. Some complaints, though, such as who is an actee, don't require that the reporter have already contacted the contracted party. But yes, we also do evaluate, in addition, whether there is something legitimate in there. For example, I like to bring up an example, Michaeli, like of an abuse complaint. Somebody complained about a blank HTML tiering on a website that was hosted through his, that was RAR. If somebody sent that complaint to us, we would realize that was not a valid abuse complaint and would not forward that to the party and would let the reporter know that that was something outside of the scope of
it. Hi, Adrian Cheek from LegitScript. So Heath rather stole my thunder, but I'll sort of go on to that. So you say that the on and you do verify and you do check that they have been done. So when the nature of the abuse certain criteria apply, yet the guy is saying, well, how are we supposed to know? Verify the answers that the registrar received. They're saying they don't know if it's legal or not. Grant replies and said, yes, of course I am. Grounds to close the complaint because we are seeing closed and the illicit activity continuing. And when we ask for clarification why that complaint has been closed, we're still being essential. Now, when that activity is saying we don't know if it's illegal or not, there are agencies and there who are willing to verify whether that information that's been provided is legitimate or not, why are we still being told it's confidential? Involved is saying they don't know if it's legal or not.
When Maggie first joined ICANN, wasn't really a complaint processing a process in place for that. And so along with consultation with the community, a whole you can see on the compliance website, there is the compliance approach. And there's two parts to that. There's the informal process and then the formal resolution process. And the informal resolution is kept confidential, and that's to encourage collaboration and feedback with the contracted party. So information provided through that does remain confidential. And actually, there's been quite a few situations that have evolved where either a registrar or a registry has identified a major gap in their process, reminders not being sent, certain verifications not being sent, disclosure of breaches, that, and those things do remain confidential in order to solve issues. It's only when it gets to that enforcement phase, then published on ICANN.org, a notice of breach and additional details provided on there. But that's the reason why that, and we do give some summaries, such as on the slide here, of some examine, and also with the requirements of the 2013 RAA, it doesn't describe exactly what action the registrar to decide, but we do need to see some sort of action from the registrar. They can't just.
So, from our point of view, there's two aspects. One, if that registrant has proved that is, obviously, us like to know that, so we can potentially an act which potentially then is legal. But again, it goes back to if it's legal or not. How are they then able to verify that the information they're being given or not without reaching out to a third? Not expecting it to be broadcast on, but at least replying back to the initial C is at least a step. Then the initial complainant can come forth and say, well, they need to do, or can they provide X, Y, Z? And we will say, yes, agree, that's legal, or actually, no, that's still an illegal act. At the moment, being kept confidential for specific, still facilitating and allowing that illegal act.
Alan Grogan, for the record. So I think one of the questions or issues here is whether registrars or ICANN are in a position to make both factual and legal determinations, right? So we get an allegation of illegal activity, which may involve an assessment both of the factual basis for that allegation, what activities is the registrant engaged in, and then is that activity legal or illegal? And registrars not have subpoena power, do not have investigatory power, do not have to go in and investigate the activities of a registrant in every country in the world. So then the question is the registrant or the registrar simply to assume the accuracy of the allegations submitted by the complaining party and act on those, or is it reasonable for the registrar to say, I'm unable to determine whether or not the party is engaged in illegal activity, therefore I'm unwilling to take action on the allegation? I think that's the issue.
Sorry, Padmini, I had a quick follow-up to that. Don't you think that in the event that there is a discrepancy that is found with an individual contracted party in your audit report, there would be public interest in disclosing that audit report where the discrepancy has been found after your formal process? And I'm talking about the registrar and the registry audit here. Once you've done an audit and there's a clear discrepancy, wouldn't the public interest override the need for confidentiality in that? Thank you.
I'm sorry, you spoke too fast. I could not keep up with you.
Oh, I'm really sorry. I tend to do that. Okay. I was saying, once you conduct an audit, a registrar audit or a registry audit, and you find out that there are discrepancies associated with the contracted party, why are these individual audit reports still confidential?
Thank you for speaking slowly.
Sorry.
It's not only the translation team who needs us to slow down also, right, guys? So thank you for your question. You are correct. And we do provide information about the discrepancies identified. The way we do that is through the audit report and also in our outreach sessions. And here's an example of what were some of the key issues that were identified during the audit process and during the review. And what happens is that, true, we finish the review of the documentation that's been uploaded. We issue what we call a preliminary report of our findings. We call it findings. And that preliminary report goes to the contracted party. They take a look at it. And they say, well, you know what? You misunderstood my response here. I'm just giving you a very simple approach. You misunderstood what I'm telling you. This is what I meant here. And that issue is a non-issue now because there's been a clarification and thus the need for collaboration. And the issue where, for example, it was a data escrow, the specification is very clear how it needs to be laid out. Thus, that is become, and as you see it here, it was our number one. We even reported that we had one. But the individual report, to come to your question, I'm not avoiding it. The individual report is between us and the contracted part, an operational report. So after the preliminary findings report, we adjust, again, it's another collaboration, it's in the informal resolution. And let's remember why we're conducting audits here, is to proactively share with the community the value or the validity of our operational aspect and how well we are the contracts are being followed. So after an initial or a preliminary finding report, we receive responses, we review, validate, and as you heard one of our questions earlier from Maxime, we send a final report to the contracted party. I still need to follow up why Maxime did not get his, because I know we sent them. We send a final report. And the final report is basically letting the contracted party knows that there are zero issues identified. So, and that closes the audit. And those that still have an issue and propose a remediation plan, we still try to respect the timeline of the audit program, issue a report, because the community is still waiting on us.
So this is just for my clarification, because I'm not sure I've understood this clearly. Say I'm a registrar, and there is some massive discrepancy that has come up, and it's been reported to you, and you start your audit, and you find your findings, and you issue to me a preliminary report of your findings, and I respond, and my response is completely unsatisfactory. You finish your audit process, and at the end of the day, you find out that the discrepancy hasn't been remedied, and your audit report finally says, this is a terrible registrar, blah, 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 they're not sorting out their discrepancies. In that event, would you still consider making it public for the community? Thank you. Was I too fast this time?
I can tell you're passionate. We love passionate people. So we do reach a scenario where we have, I don't want to call it bad. You know, we're all in this is, we're all together in it, right? But to your point, we may have contracted party who may not respond or he still is not correcting. There are two aspects of it. Lack of response, lack of providing any data. We reach what we call an enforcement phase. Again, The actual audit report that was sent to the contracted party will not be published. However, please, I don't know if you've seen our enforcement page on the notices. As Owen mentioned earlier, we have breached several contracted parties in the past during an audit program. And in that breach notice, the first page and a half is a brief summary, but then in the bottom you will see a chronology of events and the issues. So yes, if we have, community is made aware of it and we also report on it. But if there's a remediation and collaboration, we have to allow that to happen and we report to you through the audit report. Thank you.
I'm Little from Zodiac. I have two questions relating to registrar data escrow. This is the audit where you test whether the data escrow deposit with the agent, the escrow agent is the same who is. First question is, why do you need to wait for the audit to test that? Because on the day-to-day or week deposit, Iron Mountain should be able to verify that. So that's question one. Question is, if with all these new GTODs, registrars are signing up new GTOD day or every month, how do you assure or ensure the registrar is depositing all the GTOD they are selling or the data they're selling? Say, for example, this month I have 10 new GTOD, next month I have 20. How do you verify they are depositing all the 20 new GTODs data with Iron Mountain? Thank you.
Thank you, Pam, for your question. So your question is twofold. Why do we audit and not just do it through the daily or the... We do both. It's an additional validation. And I know the audit, I'm sorry, Jan could not join us this morning remotely, but they do take it to the next level, an additional validation. But you're right, Iron Mountain does, we do receive an interface or a communication, not just that the data escrow has been deposited, but also we conduct that validation that they conduct and report to us on it. So it's a combination of both. And regarding the new GTLD, I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
Yeah, so if I'm a registrar, say last month I was only selling legacy TODs, but the next month I'm selling another, I add 10 new GTODs to my portfolio. How does I can ensure that I'm depositing all those new GTODs data?
Thank you. We receive notification when that process happens. When a registrar becomes accredited for another TLD, we receive notification on that. For example, if registrar A used to be one legacy TLD, now they have 10 more within the new G world, receive notification which TLDs they have gone into agreement with a registry operator on. And then that process also then with a data escrow agent, and then they start depositing and we start the process from there.
Sorry, can you clarify how do you receive notification about which TODs a particular registrar is carrying? And how does that work with Iron Mountain's onboarding of that new GTOD escrow data or data escrow?
I see it in an email to me. I can get back to you on that one. But I know I have seen it in emails where this registrar has now these additional ones. And we also, so I can follow up specifically how do we see it and get it.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Yasmin Oma from Newstar for the record. Can we go to slide 9, I think, the general audit selection criteria, please. Okay, so I just have a few questions about this slide. Contracted parties with low responsiveness to ICANN requests, how exactly do you measure that? Is low responsiveness measured by reference to the response date? Because as far as I'm concerned, if I respond a day before the due date or 5 days before the due date, there shouldn't necessarily be a difference. The second question is about ICANN community concerns. It'd be interesting to know how you actually, what thinking goes into making a determination as to whether a registry would be audited based on the concerns. So how many people have to talk to you? What kind of issues do they have to raise with you? So this is particularly important because they are impacting whether or not I am audited. And then my next question is on the next slide, please. Point six, eligibility criteria for prospective registrars unavailable. Is it your understanding that as a registry we need to make public the eligibility criteria for registrars? So I guess my question is, when you say, when it references unavailable, it's, well, unavailable.
I'm trying to write as you were asking the questions. Let's go back to the slide. Regarding low responsiveness to ICANN request, as you heard from the community earlier and throughout, if you've been keeping up on some of the DITP requests, there is a great mystery in the community about the 1-2-3 collaboration process, even though it's published. So low responsiveness is basically not just the turnaround time with tickets and the resolution, but it's also the progression through that process in the collaborative, in the collaboration. So we have some contracted parties who sometimes wait till the third notice to respond. Well, we should not wait till the third notice to respond. So we're trying to conduct outreaches in that space, but also one-on-one calls with the certain registrars. And we're seeing much better improvements, and you could see that from the statistics that we share about first, second, and third, how it kind of narrows. As far as ICANN community concerns, we monitor different types of social media, different types of sources, communications that's going on. And you're right, we're not going to jump to everything that's going on. You have to kind of weigh it, and in perspective of the environment, and the bigger picture. Sometimes it requires us to do additional research. Sometimes it may require us to really add an aspect of to the audit in that area. The criteria number six, it's during this audit process, this was one of the requests in the RFI, and we had a couple of contracted parties who did not upload or made it available to the auditor, and that's what this criteria was about.
Just to follow up on the low responsiveness note. So it's always going to be tied lines that you communicate to us, right?
Yes.
Yeah, great. Thanks.
I'm Little Zodiac Registry again. I have a follow-up question on the new GTOD registry audit criteria. I understand the second round new GTOD audit that was in March, one of the criteria was exclusion criteria was, if you are supported, if your TOD is supported by the same back-end service provider, then you would only select one from that group of GTODs. Can you explain the rationale for that? And I would just say I have some trouble with that because I feel it would almost indirectly discriminate smaller back-end service providers and those TODs that are supported by those smaller back-end providers. For example, if a back-end provider is supporting 300 new GTODs, only one out of the 300 will be selected. If a back-end provider is supporting five, one out of five will be selected. I also want to know how you select one out of that 300 or one out of that five. Thank you.
Thank you, Pam, for your question. This is Maggie. So, minor correction to the statement you made. This past audit, yes, Jan did share in the outreach with the registry operators that a question that Jim asked earlier, not just in the registrar space, we have the same opportunities of scalability in the registry space. So what we try to do is, again, take a step back and look. For example, in this audit that was completed for the March 2015, yes, the audit took a sample because there are several back-end service providers. And what we want to do is, again, low-hanging fruit. If a sample was taken based on the different criteria that Jan shared during the outreach, but one of the criteria is we need a sample from the different back-end service providers. That helped identify few issues. And what that allows us to do is the fact that that back-end service provider is servicing whether 5, 1, or 100, at this point, not as critical as the aspect of identifying an issue. If there is an issue,
it can be addressed properly across the 5, 1, or 100. Does not mean that we're not going to include the other registry operators in future audits based on the different criteria. But we try to do what we call more of a logical approach and low-hanging fruit. So that's the explanation of how that was not like a discrimination of large or small.
Sorry, if I may follow up, but that is based on an assumption that all TODs that are supported by one backend provider are operating similarly, you know, from a technical perspective, operational perspective, business perspective. That's not necessarily the case. They might be all technically using the same infrastructure, but they have very different practices, different launch plans and business practices. So how could that be a logical assumption? I don't know. Can you address the second question? So for example, if one backend provider is supporting 5, how do you select one out of those 5? Thank you.
So thank you for your question. You stated it very well. There is an infrastructure commonality. Operationally, it may be different. Absolutely. And that's what I meant by low-hanging fruit. The infrastructure, if we can address some of the common elements, it's not going to exclude a future audit of the other contracted. So that's the logic. Now, the logic of selecting one of the 5, I think that was shared in the audit outreach when Jan explained. I don't have the document in front of me, but I can refer back to that. It's published. And if you still have questions, well, you know, we'll ask Jan to address it for you directly. Because there was a criteria that was selected.
And that's the reason I'm asking, because I couldn't make out why a particular TOD was selected.
Hello, Peter Gray, Host Europe Group. I just had a follow-up low responsiveness point, actually. Sorry to dwell on that. My question was, you mentioned that it's based on the by ICANN for the notices, but what I want to know is whether that goes a bit more granular. So would you consider, let's say you set a 7-day deadline, would you consider a registrar that responds after 3 days, or that responds after 7 days more responsive?
Good question. We're not that picky. no, it's really, if I may simplify it, process, again, The reason the timelines were more operational, right, so that we can get back to the reporters in a timely fashion. And also, you know, let's put it, if I was filing a complaint with Delta Airlines, for example, or with, you know, whatever forum, I would like to know there's a resolution and a closure. So those timelines or dates were placed. Some of them are contractually driven. Some of them are mostly operational. Whether we encourage contracted parties to respond within that timeline. Because what happens if a contracted party, and I'm looking around, I have many who respond immediately. they even ask me, don't send us notices on Friday because we can't go to bed when we see it coming from compliance. So they respond immediately, and it allows us to either address it. If there is additional follow-up, we're still following up so we do not go to the next level. If they respond on the 5th day or 7th day, whatever that timeline is, and then that response is incomplete, then we go to second notice. A lot of contracted parties, they like to respond from within that timeline. It allows for collaboration. Some contracted parties might get back to us within that timeline and say, I really need 3 more days, and here's why. We extend it. So it's not just, you know, one way. But we have the other extreme also, Peter, where contracted parties do not respond. First, third, and if you read some of the notices that have been published, notices, we breach them because they're not responding. So that's what we call by law, but that's what's meant by this. I'm explaining it to you in general, but we pull data and we look at the different areas where we launch it.
Okay. Maximal Zobin, for the record, could you investigate possibility of sending notification on really short, for services like DNS, where we have only 4 hours cumulatively over a week, not in 24 minutes, quite a lot if you're thinking about it in terms of incident, to make like 5% or maybe 3%, because when a registry has incident with DNS, saying he has no access to API, he will have to spend another 3% of SLA trying to call and investigate what's going on. Because with DNS, we have Anycast clouds. And it's not simple one server. You have different visibility of different servers tested from different distances. And even relaying the information here takes, some time, like 10 minutes or something. So in the end, operator can start doing something only in like half an hour, 40 minutes. Quite a lot comparing to 4 hours allowed over a week. You start investigating possibility of like letting some registry operators to opt out to participate in like alerting for DNS and DNSSEC in like 5 minutes or so after the failure being detected by your probes.
Thank you, Maxime, for your request. May I ask you, are you joining us tomorrow in the closed session for the registries?
Oh, sure.
Can we please bring that up again? Because we will have the technical services team with us. And it is, I think, a dialogue that's also relevant to many of the registry operators, and we'll have that dialogue with everybody in that audience. Is that okay? Thank you.
Reg Levy from Minds and Machines, and I wanted to...
Can you repeat that? You spoke too fast. Did you get it in all the languages, please? No, on a serious note, I know it's too early in the morning, but thank you very much. Actually, we appreciate the responsiveness we get from yourself and Crystal and many of the other registry operators present and registrars in the audience. Thank you for your patience with us. I know we're very persistent and we ask for a lot of data, but I want to thank you in front of the audience. Maxime.
Maxime Alzoba, short question. Do you evaluate in your internal evaluation of operators, for example, how many cases were opened in scope of registry agreement, for example, or maybe outside of scope, so they should be closed, for example. The example is some third party opens a case via CCDS complaint, and they have factual mistakes, which they provide like, yes, we did that, and even reading the complaint, visible that they forgot something. And then they complain that they were denied access, and the description of why they were denied even in the data. And still the case is opened, registry operator is just spending time on it, and in the end we'll understand that the case should never be opened. So, as I understand, the current incentive is the more cases you close, the better. But could you investigate possibility of having like negative incentive? The more cases outside of contractual scope you open, the worse it for you.
So, thank you for your question. I would like to correct one perception, and I've heard it from you twice this week. This is the second time about an incentive. I'm not clear what you mean by that, and you mentioned that compliance has an incentive to close tickets. More an obligation to the reporters to provide a response and closure. But let me address the topic you started with, Maxime. Yes, we capture and we reduce that count if it's identified as an issue. Sometimes it could be a delay in communication, it could be an patient, and we capture those either close before first notice when we identify that in the dialogue up early on, and sometimes, as we all have known, we can interpreting and we identified by your request the contracted party, and I can issue. And ICANN issues not necessarily on the compliance issue. It could be any other department we depend on for information. But we track it and we deduct it from the registry or the registrar count, and we put it on the ICANN count. So we only have 3 more minutes. So again, have a wonderful day. Thank you for joining us in this session, and have a great rest of the week.